This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Tonight we have the last year in the series of the last few weeks where we've dealt with the whole question of ahava, of love of human beings, of love of the Ribbono Shel Olam. I won't say we've dealt with the whole question, we've dealt with a very small part of the question, leading up to the point where we came with the beautiful concept of the Maharal, that the Ahavta L'Reach Ad Kamoicho Zeklal Godel Batoira, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, says Rabbi Akiva. This is a great principle in Torah, where the Maharal explained that what Rabbi Akiva is trying to say is that it's a great principle in Torah, not a great principle just in interpersonal relationships. That's certain, but the Chiddush of Rabbi Akiva is that Zeklal Godel Batoira, that this is an important principle in Torah, that one cannot progress in Torah, in one's learning and in one's practice of Yiddishkeit, unless one is excelling in the middah of loving one's neighbor as oneself. We discussed what that meant, and we came onto the concept that the easiest way to develop, or to break down the barriers of emotions and ambitions between human beings, is to be able to experience the pain of other people. And that's the first noisei ba'olim chaveiro, and in fact we pointed out that is one of the menches kinyonim. It is one of the 48 means of acquisition of Torah. The Mishnah lists 48 attributes that you need in order to become a Talmid Chacham. Quite apart from the application, the intellectual application, there are 48 character attributes which one needs to acquire. And one of them is Noisei Ba'olim Chaveiro. One has to be able to join somebody else in his suffering, to share the suffering with somebody else. And that we discussed in the last 2 weeks as being the basis of the breakdown of the barriers between individuals and their relationships with one another. And last week we had a very interesting concept where we showed that on the one hand, without Noisei Ba'olim Chaveiro, if an individual is not going to develop the ability to be able to share other people's suffering, I don't know what one would use in English, the most accurate term in English for Noisei Ba'olim Chaveiro, but I suppose it's empathy and sympathy. Does anybody know what the difference is between empathy and sympathy?
Yeah.
And sympathy? Is that your own shita? do you get that from Rabbi? Is that the MS, or you're guessing? Empathy is putting yourself in their situation. So we're talking about Noisei Ba'olim Chaveiro is empathy, to be able to empathize with somebody. We discussed that without that there is no Torah. There is Klal Godel B'Torah. It's not possible for an individual to cleave to something so spiritual as the Torah unless he's broken down the barriers between him and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if there's still barriers between him and other people, how can he start relating to him and the Ribbono Shel Olam? It doesn't begin at all. So the means of breaking down the barriers between individuals is Noisei Ba'olim Chaveiro, to learn to empathize, and through that one rids oneself. How does one empathize with somebody else? You feel that he and I are part of the same. What are we part of? We're both part of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So you're immediately feeling spiritual. But it is only possible to feel spiritual when you are able to feel at one with another human being. But if you can't feel at one with another human being, then it's not possible to feel spirituality. The Jew who stands in Yom Kippur, and with tears rolling down his face as he says, Hashem Hu Elohim, at the end of Ne'ilah, but he's unable to feel at one with another human being, those tears are false tears. Those tears are hypocritical tears. They're put on, they're not genuine. He's crying about other things, he's not crying about the Ribbono Shel Olam. Maybe he's crying because he had tzoras. Maybe he's crying because he foresees tzoras. Who knows why he's crying, but not for any great spiritual reason. It's not possible to reach spiritual peaks while you're unable to empathize with other human beings. So without empathy, we learned last week, there's nothing. Yiddishkeit doesn't start. There's just no beginning to it all. And with empathy, what is there? Malchus, we came at last week. If one is able to empathize with other human beings, then one is already on the level of a melech, one is already on the level of a king. And that's why we came out that B'nai Yisrael of the name Elohim, we're all princes. There's nothing in between. You're either os mensch or you're a king. There's no way. A Jew is not a mensch but not a king. If you're a mensch, if you qualify as a Jewish human being, you already have the qualifications of a king. And we showed last week how the work of a king, the training of a king is in being a shepherd. attending to the needs of animals, attending to low simple needs. And we developed the whole idea that a king, his entire life, is he's a man of the community, he's completely involved from morning till night working for others. And what does a slave do? Involved from morning till night working for others. So what's the difference between a slave and a king? And that's the question with which we left last week. What is the difference? What makes the one a king and the other a slave? Both have sold their bodies and souls to others. What is the difference? Mishnah says in chapter 30, Tacha Sholosh Rogzo Eretz, the world trembles because of three, the Sachas Arba Luisuchal Se'es, and there are four that the world cannot bear. One of these people, the three that causes trembling in the world, that goes against the whole nature of the world, is Eved Ki Yimloch. If a slave becomes a king, that goes against the whole nature of the world. The world can't tolerate it. It causes trembling and shakings up in the world. So we see there's something wrong with our theory last week. That whereas we brought a tremendous similarity between the Eved and the Melech, one would think that there is no greater qualification to being a king than to being a slave first. Learn how to be a slave and then you'll be a king. Like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said to his two Talmidim, do you think I'm offering you Sarona? Do you think I'm offering you an office of high position? I'm asking you to take a position of slavery. That's what public position is. It's a job of slavery. So surely the greatest form of training for Malchus should be to be a servant. And here the Rishon says, no. Eved ki yimloch, if a slave becomes a king, it shakes the world up. It doesn't work. What is Malchus? What is it to be a king? It's strange to try and understand. We think that what is it to be a king? A king is a man whose father was a king, preferably, or mother was a queen, and is born into that position, and he leads a nation, and he lives in a palace, and he wears a crown on his head, and whatever he says goes. That's what we would think is a king. But the Medrash says, for example, when Yehuda and Yosef were arguing, when Yehuda didn't recognize Yosef, Yosef was the head of Egypt, and Yehuda was trying to plead for the life of Binyamin, and Yehuda walks up to Yosef and challenges Yosef, says the Medrash, the other brothers all moved back and disappeared off the scene. And they said, two kings are busy battling, best we keep out of it. So we see that the brothers regarded Yosef and Yehuda as melochim, as kings. And in fact we see in Chazal that is so, that both of them had Malchus, and that Malchus was passed down, and that even in the time of Mashiach there will in fact be two Mashiachs. There will be a Mashiach descended from Yosef, and there will be a Mashiach descended from Yehuda. So Yosef, I understand, he was king. He was king of Egypt, he was king of millions of people. So I understand how the brothers saw him as a king at that particular point. But this is before the father has given, before Yaakov has given the brochas where he's told Yehuda that he's destined for kingship. So nobody knows about it at this point. Yet the brothers say, two kings are arguing, we're going to keep out of it. Who exactly was, what was Yehuda king of? What was his nation? Who was he, where was his territory? So he had no territory, he was wandering around, he had no country. And his population, who were his subjects? Well, Shimon was one of his subjects, and Levi was one of his subjects, and Yisachar was one of his subjects, and Zvulun. He had 10 men and one woman, one girl, Dinah. He had 11 people formed his nation. That's what he was. And yet, they call him a king. So we see really a strange concept developing, that the concept of Malchus is not dependent on having subjects. It's possible to be a king of 11 people and still to be considered halakhically and in every other way begeder Malchus, that a person is now in the category of Malchus, is in the category of kingship. And in fact we see that a melech is not a profession, it's not a career. A melech, Malchus, is a midah. It's one of the attributes of a human being. It's one of the characteristics of a human being. it is possible for an individual to acquire the characteristics of Malchus. Whether or not he has followers is not important. Yehuda had 11 people and they were his brothers and sisters, that's all he had. Yet he was a melech. And sometimes you can have kings who have nations to follow them and they're not melochim, they don't have the characteristics of a king. So we want to define not what is a king politically, not what is a king socially, but what is a king in essence. When does the Torah regard a person as a king? When does the Ribbono Shel Olam regard a person as a melech? And if one considers the difference between a slave and a melech, is very simple. It's very small and very simple. It is true that a slave works his entire life for other people. He's not working for himself at all. He gets no benefit from his work. So a king too. A melech works his entire life for his people. He doesn't have a private life. A slave doesn't have a private life. A king doesn't have a private life. What's the difference? The only difference is that a slave has to do what he's told, and the king decides himself what to do. So it's true they're both working for others, but the slave has to do what his master wants. A king has to do what his masters need, not want. And that's the difference. And it's his business to decide what they want, what they need. It's not my business to decide what you want. There's nobody in the world who is better qualified to know what you want than you. And there's no better person better qualified in the world to know what I want than I. But there is no person worse qualified to know what you need than you, and there's nobody worse qualified than I to know what I need than I. Because when it comes to needs, all sorts of different things start playing, and there are all sorts of different ideas and different ambitions. And we're not always sure what we need. What we want, we know. Every little child from the day it's born knows exactly what he wants. But it takes a lot of education and a lot of hard work on the part of parents to teach a child what he needs. That's very different. And it came as a great surprise at the Shabbaton 2 weeks ago for me to realize how many parents don't know themselves what their children need. Never mind that the children don't know what they need. No. That we understand. It takes a child. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't hold him responsible until he's 20. So that means God regards it, assumes that it takes a person 20 years to learn what he needs. But a parent? That's the job of a parent, surely. To know and understand what his child needs. That we'll talk about some other time. But that's the difference between an Eved and a Melech. An Eved responds to his master's whims. An Eved responds to his master's desires. A Melech responds to his master. In this case, his people is his master. A Melech responds to his master's needs, not to his master's wants. And who decides what the people need? The king. The Melech. That's what a king is politically. That's what a king is in social terms. If we try and project that concept a little bit further into personal and into individual terms, we'll see that it works exactly the same. There is a tremendous pressure on a national leader to do what the people want him to do. And the pressure comes in all sorts of directions. It is relentless. It's 24 hours a day, every single day of the year. He's under pressure. The moment he does something which the people feel is not what they want, polls are published. And he starts seeing that his popularity is going down. And he knows that after all, at the end of the day, his position depends on the people. Even if it's not a democracy. At the end of the day, his position depends on the people. And he sees himself becoming less and less popular. Why is he becoming less popular? Because he's not giving them what they want. And it takes a long time and a great deal of maturity to realize that one is giving what one needs, even if it's not what one wants. That takes a tremendous period of time sometimes. And in the meantime, there's all this tremendous pressure day after day on the king to do what the people want him to do. The most potent form of education, everybody knows, is by positive and negative reinforcement. When the child does something good, you give the child a sweet. When the child does something naughty, you take away the sweet. There's no better form of education. You make somebody feel good when they've done something right, and you make somebody feel sore when they've done something wrong, on whatever level of education one is operating. And a nation tries to educate its leaders the same way, by punishing them when they do wrong, and by making them feel good when they do right. showing them great covered, and the poles go up and they love them and they run around them and they laud them, and it's all wonderful, and what they say about them is all beautiful when things are going well. And when things are not, it's very tough for a leader. But the nation works on the basis not of what they need, but on the basis of what they want. So what middle does the king need? If a king is going to succeed in terms of malchus, what middle does he need? What characteristic does he need? He needs an iron character, a character of steel. He needs the ability to decide what the people need. And in that decision, he doesn't consult with the people. He might communicate with them in order to get a feel of what they need, but not from their opinions. It's a lonely decision that he's going to take all on his own. After studying his people, understanding his people, he's going to take the decision, this is what the people need. And he's got to be able to live with that decision. And he's got to be able to see that decision through. And he's got to be able to withstand the pressure. And he's got to be able to sleep at night despite what they're writing about him in the newspaper. And he's got to be able to smile the next day despite what they're saying about him on the television. And he has to continue to operate with full confidence after all the economists write about him that his economic theories are suicidal, and all the social scientists write that what he's doing to the society is absolutely destructive, and all the peaceful people decide that what he's doing for armaments is destroying the world, and all the military people decide that what he's doing is just not enough, and whatever he does, he's got it on both sides, and whatever paper he picks up, he'll find some reason why what he's doing is going to destroy the country. And that's all he reads day and night. Pick up any newspaper in the country, published and written in the country of its own government, and see how much praise you will find for its leadership. See how often you will find an article of congratulation, an article of lauding the foresight that there is. I don't know if you noticed an article in the paper just the other evening. Oh, so happens that the economic recovery in America is going to be good for Mr. Reagan. But it's important to understand that it's not because of Mr. Reagan, it's in spite of Mr. Reagan. The Gedolim. And he's going to read this thing every day. A year ago when he tried to do what he did, they told him it would ruin the country. Then he did it, and it didn't ruin the country. It pulled it out of recession. Now what do they say? Yeah, but it wasn't you, it was in spite of you. Jolly lucky you are. Good luck. Imagine how good it would have been if you weren't at the top. Nebuch, the poor man. And one has to be able to sleep at night and be fresh the next morning and keep a sense of humor and smile at everybody and receive everybody b'seva ponim yofes and do chesed with everybody and kindness with everybody and not take it out on one's wife and children and carry on living a normal life. And Reagan has got a choice, 4 years or 8 years. That's his big choice in life. But imagine the poor kings for life. For life they had to take this with no way out. They couldn't resign, they couldn't retire, there was no end of term of office, nothing. And to know that their children were going to go through exactly the same thing. How much of a king's life was pleasant? How much of a king's life was one of satisfaction in terms of being appreciated? It's just not the nature of people to do that. It's the nature of people to resent he who tells them what they need, and to love those who give them what they want. So love is not going to be, it is the destiny of a king not to be loved. If he's fortunate and skillful, he will be respected, but never loved. That's not, if he's loved, there's something wrong. He needs to be original. Where does he get his ideas from? There are only two sources he can have. His people. He's either going to get his ideas from the newspapers, from the economists, from his ministers, from the public, from the press, or he's going to develop his own ideas. Those are the only two sources. So he needs to be original. Because if he isn't going to have his own ideas, he's going to take their ideas. But their ideas are what they want, not what they need. Their ideas are by definition possible. It might happen that by a stroke of luck, because in a nation there will be so many opinions, one of them is likely to be right. But you can't take it from there. He's got to sit and fathom it himself. He's got to work out himself what I'm going to do. He's got to work out himself what they need. And he's got to come out with original solutions to problems. He can't merely adopt, listen to a whole lot of views and say, okay, we'll take yours. That's not kingship. That's influence. And eventually, whose view is he going to take if he operates that way? And that's also been a criticism. If the kings already do, or the leaders do already take the counsel of their ministers, then what do the newspapers start writing? He's just a puppet of the ministers. He hasn't got a mind of his own. Whoever happens to put the strongest argument that day, that's what he takes. Gentlemen and ladies, read Time magazine every week and read the American section, and you will understand that that's how it is. Not just in that country, but that's a country whose press we can read objectively because it's not ours, and it's in English so we can understand it. But it's the same in any country. And keep old editions and see what they used to say and what they're saying now, and how stupidly inconsistent it is. As long as it's to show that he's not doing his job properly. He needs originality. Originality and independence of thought and of action. That's what a melech needs. He's got to be able to conceive of his own ideas and put them through and stick with them if they're right, and change them if they're wrong, and see it through despite whatever pressures he's put up against. That's it. And the last reason to change direction is because of pressure from the people. You can change direction because maybe somebody's pointed out to you a flaw in your thinking, and you accept it's wrong, I made a mistake, so you change. But mere pressure from the people, that's not what they want. That's not where they want to go. A melech who says, no, in that case, I must go where you want to go, is denying the very essence of malchus. There are two kinds of leadership. There's what we call leadership from the bottom up and leadership from the top down. The whole system of Torah leadership operates, that it comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately. The Ribbono Shel Olam, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moshe got it in Sinai, and he gave it over to Yeshua, and Yeshua gave it to the Zakenim. So the whole elective process, who chose Moshe? God chose Moshe. Who chose Yeshua? God as well, but through Moshe. Moshe chose the next one. And the Zakenim? Also. This wasn't a government elected from the bottom upwards. And we in the Western world operate today with governments that are elected by the mass of people, and unfortunately the mass of people are the least educated, the mass of people are the least intelligent, and the mass of people are the least noble, and they are the ones who elect the government, and the government is responsible to them. So it's a government from the bottom up. Who is really ruling? The lowest common denominator of society is who is really ruling. And that is so in the political and social situation is serious enough. But one has to be very careful not to allow that to infiltrate into our own homes and into our own institutions and into our own communities. That's not the way we operate. The children don't run the home. You don't do what the children want. Children have to learn at a very early age that leadership is from up down. That's how leadership works. They do what the parents want, not the other way around. And so it is in communities, and so it is in institutions, that there has to be decision making by people who are prepared to take independent judgments and to stick by them. That's malchus. But what is the real training ground for this malchus? There's a beautiful medrash in Miketz. Omer Rabben Shimon ben Gamliel, Yosef Mishelo Nosnu Lo. The throne that was given to Yosef belonged to him. This is another lovely concept. A Jewish king is not appointed. Even the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, doesn't appoint him. David was appointed by the Ribbono Shel Olam, but then it goes. And we're talking now not just about the political king, we're talking about the middah of malchus. It's not conferred on a person externally. Malchus is something that comes from inside. Yosef Mishaloi Nosnu Lo. What they gave to Yosef was his own. He earned it. He deserved it. Piv Shaloi Noshak Ba'aveiro. His mouth, which did not kiss in Aveiro. So Paro says to him, Va'al picho yishak kul ami. By your mouth all my people will be fed. Again, that the Medrash ties up the mouth to the mouth. It's not for nothing that Paro perceived Kedusha in the mouth of Yosef. But where does that Kedusha come? Where does that independence come? Where does that Malchus come? So Paro is giving Malchus, he's giving the throne to his mouth. That Yosef did himself. He avoided any Aveiro with his mouth. Gufoi shaloi noga ba'avera, his body that had no contact with avera. By yilbash oisei bigdei shesh. So the Paro gave him clothes, royal clothes. Savoru shaloi hilchin la'avera, his neck which he never bent to avera. By yosin revid azov al savoru, he gave him a golden necklace. Yodov Shiloi Mishmishu Ba'Aveira, his hands who never touched Aveira. Vayasur HaMelech Istabosem Yal Yodov Vayitin Osa El Yad Yosef. The king gave his ring and put it onto the finger of Yosef. Raglov Shiloi Posu Ba'Aveira, his legs that never walked to Aveira. Vayarkei Vosu B'Markeves HaMishna Asheloi. And they drove him in the TJ2, in the second Rolls Royce that Paroi had for such a purpose. His intellect which never thought of an Avera. So they gave him the name, the title Avrech, which means Av b'chochma v'rach b'shonim, a father in wisdom, although young in years. What is the Midrash trying to tell us? To rule over people is hard, because every person has a different desire and every person has a different ambition, and there's no way that the ambitions of everybody can be satisfied. There is a way through skillful leadership that the needs of every individual can be satisfied, and that's hard enough, but the ambitions of everybody being satisfied is not possible, and therefore it's difficult to lead the people, but it's possible. The closer the people one is leading are to oneself, the more difficult it becomes. If one is leading a foreign nation and all you have to do is issue an edict and offer his head and it really doesn't matter, that's okay. But when you've got to say off with your head to somebody who's close to you, to a friend, to somebody who was loyal to you, to a member of your family, then it becomes a lot more difficult. What happens when you've got to say off with your own head? Then it becomes impossibly difficult. The most difficult act of Malchus is to lead yourself. Because we're an Olam Katan, the Chachamim say. We are a little world. Every human being is a little world on his own. He has thousands and thousands of ambitions and desires and thoughts and feelings and emotions. Hundreds of thousands of different ones, all pulling in different directions. He has different desires. He has different needs. His needs and his desires never tie up. What he wants is not what he needs, and what he needs is not what he wants. And somebody has to take him in hand and has to make certain decisions. And these decisions have to be made with independence of thought and of action. Independent from who? Independent from society, and independent from oneself, which is the hardest of all. To be independent from the people on the other side of the world is relatively easy. It's becoming more and more difficult with television and with newspapers, but it's relatively easy. To be independent from other people in one city is a little bit harder, but it's still possible. To be independent from one's friends and one's society and one's community is devilish difficult. But to be independent of oneself, how does one do it when one is being pulled in so many directions? That is Malchus. That's what Yosef was able to do. Piv shalei noshach ba'aveiro. Gufo shalei noga ba'aveiro. His mouth had wants. His body had wants. His hands had wants. His legs had wants. And there was somebody there able to say, no, that's not what you need. Who says it's not what you need? I say it's not what you need. But everybody else does it. That I'm king here. I'm not affected by what everybody else does. I will have to take my own decisions as to what is right and what is wrong, what you need and what you don't need, and that's the end of the story. And here we come to the full definition of Malchus. Malchus is a man who is able to think and act independently and with courage, independently both of himself, or the other way around, independently both of society and also of himself. There's a very beautiful and sad Chazal in Sanhedrin Daf Kaf Amud Beis. The Gemara says, "Omar Resh Lokish, Resh Lokish said, Bitchilo, in the beginning, Molach Shlomo al Ha'elyonim. Shlomo was king not only of this world, but even of angels and the higher worlds. He was the Melech there. He was able to master them. He was able to be independent of them." Malach al ha'tachtonim, And later on, he lost that ability. And Foshim say it was when he took so many wives. No longer was he on the level to be a melech by Elyonim as well, to be independent even of the higher world. But he remained a melech b'tachtonim. He remained a king of the of the complete world in this world. He was completely independent. The libesoif. Later on in his kingship, loy malach elad Yisrael, he had lost his throne over the whole world, and he was now a melech al Yisrael. He was now a king over the whole Jewish people. The libesoif loy malach elad Yerushalayim. Later on, he considered himself only as being king in Yerushalayim. That's all he really was king of. Shneimar, as it says in the beginning of Koheles, Divrei Koheles ben David, Melech b'Yerushalayim. He introduces himself as Koheles, that Shlomo, the son of David, king of Yerushalayim. Why didn't he say king of the world? Because he wasn't king of the world anymore. Why didn't he say king of Israel? He didn't feel himself even as having complete shlita over the whole of Israel. V'libasoif loy molach elo al mitosre. At the end, he only felt that he was a king over his own bed. Believe a soif, and at the very end, lo molach ela al makle, he was only a king over his stick. And it's talking, David, that's the story that you referred to in the shiur the other night. When Ashmedoi, our same Ashmedoi from the Gemara in Pesachim, who was the king of the ghosts, a really dangerous sort of fellow. And Shlomo had to have various dealings with him because Shlomo needed to build the Beis HaMikdash, and he's told that you can't build the Beis HaMikdash with any tools of iron, and he needed to chisel and to break stones. So they told him that Ashmedoi is the one who knows the secret. He knows about the how to do such things. And there's a beautiful story that the Gemara in Gittin says as to how Shlomo sent a very clever man to go and find Ashmedoi, the king of the ghosts. It was very difficult, so he was told that there's a particular well of water, and Ashmedoi covers it with a lid, and he seals it with his own seal, and then he flits between heaven and here. He goes backwards and forwards, and he does his business, and whenever he's thirsty, he comes once a day and he drinks from the well. So this fellow had to capture Ashmedoi. That was the first job. Before you could find out how to do such things, Ashmedoi had to be captured. So if he would open the well and poison it or do anything, Ashmedoi would immediately notice that the seal was broken. So this is, in fact, it's from here. I think it's from this Gemara that some of the modern hijack or anti-hijack teams have worked out how to handle the hijackers. What this person did was he built two wells. One, this well was on a hill, so he built one well just below Ashmedoi's well and another well just above Ashmedoi's well. First, he connected the bottom well with Ashmedoi's well with a little tunnel, so all the water flowed out of Ashmedoi's well into the second well, and he sealed it. He closed it. Then he plugged that connection, and he opened a connection between the top well and the middle well, Ashmedoi's well and the top well, and he filled the top well with wine. So the wine flowed into Ashmedoi's well, and the seal was still unbroken. So Ashmedoi came back from his day's business, looked, saw the seal was okay, opened the seal, and noticed there was wine there, it wasn't water, and he knows Ashmedoi is a very, very clever guy, and he knew that it was no good taking it for a ghost to drink wine. It's looking for trouble. So he lays off the wine until he gets so thirsty that he won't drink from any other well, because he knows that there are people that are out to poison him. So eventually, look, he's very thirsty. He'll take wine rather than die of thirst. So he drinks the wine. And he falls asleep, and he gets captured and taken off to Shlomo. And Shlomo questions him as to how to build the Beis HaMikdash. And he tells Shlomo about the Shamir, about the special kind of insect that could actually sit on a piece of stone and would split the stone. But the Shamir is a bird. There's a particular bird that handles the Shamir, and that bird has been sworn to secrecy, not to let the Shamir go to anybody. So Shlomo there found the bird, and he took the babies of the bird, and he put the babies under a glass covering, and the bird came to try and get the babies, and she couldn't get to the children because there was glass on top. So she went to fetch the Shamir, and she put it on the glass to slip the glass. And Shlomo took the Shamir, and the bird committed suicide because he broke his promise, or she broke her promise. That's how the Shamir was captured. Not nice, hey, Olin, shame. But that's what happened. Anyway, Ashmedoi and Shlomo then had some dealings with one another, and they had some very interesting discussions, which are recorded in the Gemara. But when Shlomo was becoming too familiar with Ashmedoi, Ashmedai actually gave him some kind of shock and pushed him off his chair quite far. And you can imagine the humiliation of Shlomo suddenly lying on the floor and having to get up. Rashi says it's at that moment that Chazal say that there was a king lying on the floor. He was a king over his stick, that's all he had, that's all he was king over. And Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz asks, what does it mean he was king over, what's king over a stick? Anybody can be king over a stick. King is over a nation. And if he's lost his nation, if he's lost his status as a king because he's sprawled all over the ground, how can you call him a king over a stick? So we see here again that Malchus is not a social position, and it's not an occupation, and it's not a profession. Being a king is a middah. There are some people who are kings over nations. There are some people who are kings over cities. And there are some people who are just kings over their own homes. And there are some people who are just kings over themselves. And there are some people who are just kings over their stick. That's all they're kings over. But they retain the middah of Malchus even in their relationship between them and their stick. The way they stand. The way they hold their stick. The way they bear themselves. The way they walk. The independence. The courage. The integrity. And the originality. That's a matter. And one can see him from miles away. One can see a matter. A man who's not blown, as the Telzerov says, in the direction of whichever breeze happens to be blowing at that time. That's Malchus. Today there is a tremendous pressure to conform. The pressure for conformity is very, very heavy. We mentioned earlier the pressure that is brought to bear upon a leader, upon a political leader. But that same pressure is brought on every human being with tremendous weight and with tremendous pressure. It's brought in the professions, it's brought in business, it's brought in society, and it's brought in religion too. I don't know why it is, as the world gets smaller and smaller in stature, it finds it more and more difficult to tolerate independence of thought and to tolerate originality of ideas. It becomes something which has to be, the world has to reject somehow. It's a very strange thing, but that's what is happening. And it's something one needs to develop the middah of Malchus to counter. One has to be able to develop one's ideas of what is right and what is wrong by one's own judgment, not by what people are saying and what people are doing. One needs to develop one's own style and one's own understanding. However, does that mean that one has to be totally independent? One has to be careful also. It's interesting that the Hebrew word for originality is makoriyut. Where does that word come from? Makor, with a source. So Jewish originality is not something that you pull out of your finger. Jewish originality is something you find a source for, but nobody else has found it yet. That's what's original. Not that you've made something up new. That's not Jewish. That's not Torah. If you've made something up new, that's philosophy, that's reformation, it can be what you want to call it, but it's not Torah. Torah has to have a makor, it must have source. So where's the makoriyut then? Where's the originality? In the very word makoriyut, I've found a source. But there has to be a makor. Somebody said something the other day which I find terribly disturbing, because I know it's something which is quite widespread in various different forms. This is a lady who was talking about her husband, and she said, you know, you must understand, my husband's a very great man, he's very independent, and he doesn't need a rav, he doesn't need a rebbe. He has his own hashkofas already, and he has his own derech, he has his own way of doing things already. And by the way, this wasn't the Rebbetzin of the Steitler or Rav Shach or one of these people. So the immediate response is very interesting. Reb Chaim Volozhiner needed a Rebbe. The Beis Halevi needed a Rebbe. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik needed a Rebbe. The Briskerov needed a Rebbe. Your husband is already doesn't need a Rebbe anymore. Number one. Number two, what is interesting is that this particular person never had a Rebbe. It's not somebody who had a Rebbe and thinks he's grown out of one, which is also nonsensical. Somebody who never had it was never mekabel Torah from an individual. He believes it's not necessary. He's heard shiurim here, he's listened from this one, he's learned from that one, it's picked up in Sforim, he can learn a bit, he can understand a bit. And his belief is it's not necessary. I have my own derech. I'm original, I'm independent. That one has to understand very, very carefully. And I need to go over two chazal that I did with you once before, which Reb Chaim Shmuelevitz brings. Tanu Rabbonu, we learned in the Braisa, Maiseh b'Rabbi Eliezer. There was a case with Rabbi Eliezer, Sheshovas b'Golil Ha'elyon, who was spending a bit of time in the Upper Galilee. So if Rabbi Eliezer is there, all the Chachomim of the place took the opportunity to go and discuss things with him. V'sha'aluhu shloishim halochus b'hilchus sukkah. And they came to ask him 30 dinim, 30 halochas about sukkahs that they wanted clarification on. 12 he said yes, I have heard answers to these questions and these are the answers. And on 18 he said, I'm sorry, I haven't been told the answers to this. And Rashi points out that he's not saying that I don't know. Don't think I'm saying this because I haven't put a lot of effort into trying to understand these same 18 points that you're asking me. I could, but I haven't heard that. I wasn't taught anything on these particular points. So they said to him, Lo shamati. So Amru lo kol dvarecha enan ela mipi hashmua. Rabbi Eliezer, they said, are you a tape recorder? Did we come just to ask you what you've heard? Aren't you capable of original thought? We came all this way to come and meet with you because we heard you were in Golil Ha'Elyon to ask you 30 questions that all of us couldn't figure out. Why did we come to you? Not because you might have heard from somewhere. We've also been around listening. We haven't heard. We came to ask you because we haven't heard. We don't want to hear from you also. I haven't heard either. Give us an original answer. Amar lehem iskaktuni loyma dovah shelo shemati mipi rabbeisa. Are you trying to pressurize me to say something that I didn't hear from my rabbein? That's although he knows answers, he could suggest answers, he could give answers which he's confident are right, but he didn't hear them from his rabbein. And he says, you must know there are a few things that I've stuck to throughout my life without exception. Never in my life has anybody been in the Beis HaMedrash before me. Every single day of my life I've been the first one in the Beis HaMedrash. Number one, v'lo yoshanti b'beis hamedrash. Number two, I've never slept in the beis hamedrash. V'lo sheinas keva, v'lo sheinas haroi. In those days, they very often used to sit in the beis hamedrash for days on end, and they used to actually lay themselves out to sleep a little bit in the night time. So he says, not sheinas keva, I didn't sleep in the night time, a proper lying down. V'lo sheinas haroi, I didn't even take a little nap during a shiur or in between shiurim. And I've never left anybody in the Beis HaMedrash. I was always lost out. First in and lost out, as the accountants say. And I've never talked nonsense. I've never talked lightly. And I've never ever said something which I've not heard from my rabbi. That says Rabbi Eliezer. Ask Reb Chaim Shmuelevitz. In Ovis, the Rabbi Nosson in the sixth Perek. There's the famous story of the origins of Rabbi Eliezer when he became a big Talmud Chochem. And his father, who was supporting him, had found out that he was learning in yeshiva and didn't approve and had come to the yeshiva to try and disinherit him. And they sat down at a shir before the father turned up. And when the father came, he took a seat on the base of Medrash. Amru, and they said, Oysu Hayoim Nosson Einov Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai b'Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the Magid Shir, he was the Rosh Yeshiva that day, can you imagine? Rabbi Eliezer is just one of the Talmidim. They were all of that kind of status, probably even greater than him. The Magid Shir is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And you can imagine in the trembling that used to go on before the Shir as to who Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was going to call on to read, to say the Shir, to say something. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looked around and he picked on Rabbi Eliezer. Romalin, he said, Psach the Drash, he says, you give the Shir today, Eliezer. Your turn today. He says, sorry Rabbi, I can't do it. He pressed it, you must do it, you will do it. And the Talmidim also said, Eliezer, come, we want to hear the shiur, tell us what you've got to say. He got up and he opened and he gave a shiur,
And he said things in that shir that no human ear had ever heard before. Not chidushim that you find in other sforim or that somebody else has said something similar. Chidushim, new ideas that nobody had ever said before. Omed Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai got up, and he put his arms around Rabbi Eliezer and he kissed him. V'yomalu, and he said, Rabbi Eliezer, Rebbe, my teacher, Rabbi Eliezer, he now calls his student my teacher. Emes l'madat l'madatayne, you've taught me emes kai today, you've taught me true things today, things that I didn't know. This is the same Eliezer who says, I have never uttered a word that I didn't hear from my teacher. And here his teacher turns around to him and says, Eliezer, you've told us things that nobody's heard before. Yet he calls him Rebbe because you've taught me. What's going on? Says Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, it was never the intention of Chazal to make puppets out of people. And it was never the intention of Chazal to make parrots and tape recorders out of people. Merely to repeat what your Rebbe said, that you don't have to be a Talmid Chacham. That's not what Rabbi Eliezer means when he says, that I've never said something which I didn't hear from the mouth of the teacher. So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, what it means is that a Talmid has to be so well versed in the approach of the teacher, in the method of the teacher, in the style of the teacher, that when he is mechadish, when he says something new, he is sure at all times that what he's saying fits in with the style and with the approach of the Rebbe. That is sure. That there is nothing that he is saying which is outside the framework of his particular style of the way he's being taught. And here we have the combination, the strange combination of the faithfulness to Makoros, the faithfulness to a source, and yet the possibility for originality. If there is no in originality, if there is no Makoris, there is no Malchus, that's not a king. That's not the middle of a Talmid Chacham. To talk and to say things, the same things that have been said before, in the same way that it's been said before, merely repeating, that's not it. It is necessary for a Talmid Chacham, for a Ben Torah, to be able to create a new, to throw a new light on something. To say something in a new way perhaps, to understand it from a different angle, to reveal something that hasn't been revealed before. We say in the davening every Shabbos and every Yom Tov, V'sein chelkeinu b'seirosecho. Give us our part in your Torah. And some of the Mefoshim explain that every human being has a part in Torah which only he is suited to reveal. Each person is different, he has a different personality, he will notice things differently. When two chavrusas sit and look at a piece of Gemara, each one sees things differently and they're able to notice things differently. They're looking at the same Gemara. They can be revising the same shir which both of them heard. And each one has a slightly different way of doing it. Where does all that come from? Every individual has his place in Torah which nobody else can reveal. There are secrets of the Torah which are left for each one of us to reveal. If we'll only make the effort to expose ourselves to it, to develop our own originality, but that originality has to be within the framework of our Rabbi. It cannot be ever without that framework. A musician wants to make music, it has to be original. If one composer is merely going to make the same music that those that went before him made, it's going to be ridiculous. They'll call it a crib and a fraud, and so it will be. It has to be original. But not outside the framework of musical rules and laws. Not outside the framework of the musical style he was taught by his teacher. That's called noise, it's not called music. It has to be within the framework and in accordance with the rules. So an individual has to learn how to be creative and original within the framework that he's been given by his rabbi. But there is this tremendous confusion that I mentioned earlier of seeing the ultimate as becoming independent from a rabbi. One becomes independent from the rabbi in the sense that one no longer has to sit under his apron strings. Yes, one is able to move away. One is able to work on one's own. But one works on one's own in accordance with the line he has given one. One might become greater than one's Rebbe. One might outgrow and overgrow one's Rebbe. Nothing could be greater and nothing could be more wonderful. But it's along the line that the Rebbe has set. It's a continuation of the same framework and a continuation of the same line that has been set by the Rabbein. The independence that we're talking about takes tremendous self-discipline. The independence that we're talking about takes tremendous skill. We're talking about being creative and independent within a framework. the creativity and the independence is what makes it malchus. What gives it the ability, the confidence to be able to stick with it is because you know it's in accordance with what you've been taught. No person can make up something new and stick it out under pressure. Who says I'm right? The whole world is shouting at me I'm wrong, maybe I should back down. But if you say, you know, the whole world is shouting, but that's how I was taught by my rabbi, nothing has to change. There's no reason to give way. There's no reason to get all shaken up. There's no reason to have sleepless nights because one has that confidence. Although that isn't the exact thing I was told by my Rebbe, but one thing I know for sure, my Rebbe would approve. It's in accordance with his system. It's in accordance with his way. But the most important area of that expression is in one's mastery over oneself. The ability to handle, to control, to give oneself what one needs and not to give oneself what one wants. I think in short, the difference between Malchus and the negative independence which I'm talking about is the kind of independence which a gypsy has. A gypsy will tell you, I'm a melech, I'm a king, I'm not tied to anybody, I'm not tied to anything, I live in my caravan, I've had enough here, I go there, I've had enough there, I go somewhere else. Who's a king like me? And we say, you silly gypsy. What kind of melech? Where's the malchus? But on the surface he seems to be right, he's not tired, I'm not affected by any society, I keep on moving. And one finds one is finding more and more, and increasingly disturbing, not only here but overseas too, what I call gypsy Yiddishkeit, gypsy frumkeit, where people think that to be independent means to flit around here a little bit, there a little bit, I daven here, I daven there, I go to shiurim here, I go to shiurim there, I'm independent, I go all over the place. It's not independent, that's a gypsy, that's never somebody who's homeless. You can go all over the place as a guest if you have your own home. You have a place, this is my home. You want to try this, and you want to hear this, and you want to go there. That one can do as long as one has a home. But the gypsy doesn't have a home. It's not that he has a home and he's independent in his home from everything around him. He's not independent at all, he doesn't have a home. And so it is in Yiddishkeit, one needs a home. One needs a home for one's davening. One needs a home for one's learning. One needs a home for one's tradition. One needs a home for one's source. One needs a home for one's roots. If one has a home, one can go traveling, because one always comes back home and one feels secure in one's travels and one can be independent in one's travel. But if one doesn't have a home at all, that's a gypsy, that's not a melech. On that very pasuk with which we opened, Eved ki yimlech, a slave who becomes a king, is one of the things that shake up the world, says the Vilna Gaon. What does it mean? Perush Eved, what is a slave? Defines it exactly as we've developed the idea. A slave is a man who's a slave to himself. That's what an eved is. A man who does what he wants is a slave. We tend to think that a man who does what he wants is a free man. No, doing what you want is not freedom. Doing what you want is the ultimate of slavery. Because you're unable to do what you need. You can only do what you want. And being a king is being able to do what you need, which is usually not what you want. Being a king is to be able to stay awake when you feel like going to sleep. It's like the ability to go to sleep when you feel like staying awake. It's the ability to eat when you don't feel like eating because it's the right time to eat. And not to eat when you do feel like eating. It's the ability to get up and say something when something needs to be said, even if it will make you unpopular, even if it will embarrass you. And it's the ability to keep quiet when one needs to keep quiet, even though you're exploding, you're clutching to say something. That's a melech. A man who does what he wants is not a melech, he's an eved, he's a slave. I spoke a little bit earlier about parents and I said we will come back to it and shiurim and shiurim and shabbatons and weekends and I don't know what, because to see a generation being destroyed is rather disturbing. But where is a child going to be taught malchus? When is a child going to be taught you don't do what you want? There is a time to go to sleep, there is a time to eat, there's a time to keep quiet, there's a time to talk. A parent who isn't even a melech over his own children, who is he going to be melech? Says the Vilna Gaon, Tachas Eved, Perush Eved, Umishoyse, Maisim, Royim, Vuhu Eved, Lietzer Hara. And what does it mean, Kiyim Loch? That the world gets shaken up when he becomes a melech. Shehei Melech al Rabbim, when he takes it upon himself to become a melech among many other people. Again, I must mention very briefly, and we finish now, another disturbing tendency. These are all tendencies which one observes and which are very worrying if not held in check. In the old days, A Talmud in yeshiva's greatest ambition was to stay in yeshiva as long as possible. To remain a Talmud. Why? Because he liked the security. No. He didn't want the responsibility of going out as a rov in the community. He used to have to be thrown out. The Rosh Yeshiva used to have to go to him and say, I'm expelling you from the yeshiva. Where shall I go? There's a job for you in this little village. They need a rov. You go and be the rov. Me, be a rov. And you know who the people were who used to say that? Talmidei Chachomim, you can't imagine what they knew, what they'd been through, who they'd learnt by. And if we take some of the small people of one generation above us, our parents' generation, just some of the ordinary people, who were their rabbeim? Never mind the great people, the one generation before that. How great they were, what they were exposed to. A man who sat by the Chofetz Chaim for 15, 20 years, a man who sat by the Brisker Rav, a man who sat by the Telzerov, a man who sat by the Alter from Slabotka for 15, 20 years. You know how great these people were. And the rabbein would come and say, look, you know, it's time you went out and you took a position. Me, a position? Who am I to take a position, to make decisions, to tell other people what to do? And they would be pressurized and pressurized and pressurized, and eventually they would be pushed out of the yeshiva and they would go. That's how it would happen. Today it's the other way around. A young man who has difficulty in reading Aleph Beis goes to yeshiva, or learns wherever it is, not necessarily in yeshiva, and as soon as he's learning Aleph Beis already and he's up to Dalit, he's becoming a Rebbe already. Now he's got Talmidim, he's teaching them Aleph and Beis, he knows Aleph and Beis, and he's up to Hay, and he's already up to Gimel with his Talmidim, and he's up to Vav, he's already up to Hay with his Talmidim, and he's already discussing philosophy with them and ideas with them and directing them and advising them and Shiduchim and yeshivas and where they should go and what they should do. A gross Rebbe already. Eved ki yimlech. The first thing is, it's difficult to get to these madrigas. Nobody can get to these madrigas in full, but one has to be conscious of it. The shakes up the word sheyehei melech harabim dahaynu sheyehei loymeidim acherim. A person who is not yet a king on himself. A person who is not yet able to say no to himself. A person who is not yet able to force himself to do things which he doesn't want to do, and force himself to do things, not to do things which he does want him to do. A person who is not able, and who starts teaching other people Torah, not even teaching, says the Vilna Gaon, lo meid im acherim, even learning chavrusa. It shakes up the world, says Mishli, tachas sholosh rog zoeret, the world trembles when that happens. It's so unnatural, it's so wrong, it's so against everything. Who are you to be teaching me Torah when you can't say no to yourself? Who are you to be telling me what's right and wrong? Who are you to be studying with me? Nebuch, we're all in this kind of situation, and if we didn't practice, the Torah wouldn't be taught at all. But one has to understand that there is, that this is the aim, this is where we're trying to get to. That the first step in learning Torah with others, the first step in forming a community of people, the first step in chavrusas getting together, in chaburas getting together, is that there shouldn't be an eved ki yimlech. That the people involved should be people who have at least developed the self-discipline of malchus. As we mentioned last week, Malchus is a very high level, it's a very high madrega on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a very low madrega. Without Malchus, there's nothing. A Jew is either a king or he's a gornet. There are no citizens, we're all kings. You know the famous story with the, I think it was told a long time in Ben Gurion's day already, it was told with Ben Gurion and Truman, I think it was originally. The story's gone down the generations. Where Truman says to Ben Gurion when they met, why are you looking so tired? What a little nation of 2 million people. Look at me, I've got 100 million people, or however many it is, and I'm bouncing around and full of life. What's wrong with you? He says, you've got 150 million people, I've got 2 million presidents. And it's true. Every Jew has the capacity to be a melech. And if he's not a melech, he's a gornet. There's nothing in between, he's an eved. One is either an eved or a melech. One either can control oneself and direct oneself, in which case one has the midas of malchus, or one cannot control and direct oneself, in which case one has the midas of an eved. And there's no way one can be independent of society if one is not yet independent of oneself. There is no way one can make original decisions and conduct oneself with originality and be able to perceive things with originality if one is unable to be able to perceive oneself and to lead oneself with originality and with independence. That need of independence, the need to be independent, is first and foremost the need to be a master over oneself. That's the first step. And then within the framework of one's rabbi, within the framework of one's teachers, to take their systems and to take their derochim, and with their derochim and with their systems to reveal new makoros, to reveal new sources, new ideas, new concepts, to throw new light on the way one should be, and to behave in accordance with one's understandings, and to behave in accordance and consistently with one's decisions. That's the Malchus that we're talking about. That concludes the series. The Ahava, love of oneself, is the closest form of Ahava. We talked about the two systems, the one of the Akedah and the one of the Maharal, as far as Ahavat Hashem is concerned. Can there be love of somebody very distant from oneself? The Akedah said yes, provided one has tremendous respect for that person, and in addition he also dishes out chesed. One can develop a love for somebody who's very far from one if he's very great in one's eyes and he dishes out chesed. The Maharal says no, there's only love of people who are part of you and very close to you, and that's why there is no chiyuv to love a parent because there's a generation gap, and there's no chiyuv to love a Rebbe because there's a great distance. The chiyuvim there are only of yira, only of respect. But there is a chiyuv to love the Ribbono Shel Olam, says the Maharal, because we are part of the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately. But how do we feel that part of Ribbono Shel Olam? By after the Reach HaKamocha, by feeling a relationship between individuals, then we can feel that we're all part of one big whole. But if we can't feel that we're part of one another, how can we feel that we're part of the Ribbono Shel Olam? And that's why it's Zeklal Godol B'Torah. This is a great principle in Torah, says the Maharal. And we discussed how one sets about feeling that. How does one begin to feel that you and I are the same? And we said the easiest way to feel that is when you will be struck and I will feel pain. That's when I'll be able to feel that we're part of the same body. And that is the concept of Nosei Ba'olim Chaveira. We then developed the idea that Nosei Ba'olim Chaveira, the ability to empathize with others, to feel other people's pain, is in fact the midah of Malchus. It's the midah of kinship. And we then asked last week, what is the difference between a king and a slave? Both are dedicated to their masters, both are dedicated to others, both are working only for others. They don't have a private life, they don't have an individual life, they only work for the public. And we answered this evening that there's one very small difference between the Eved and the Melech, but it's a very great difference. It's true that both the Eved and the Melech work their entire lives for somebody else, but the Eved does what the master wants him to do, and the king does what the master needs him to do. The Eved is not the one who decides what the master wants him to do, because the most competent person to decide what you want is you yourself. The Melech decides what his master needs, because the Melech is the most competent person to decide what you need. And we then discussed the concept that Yosef's Malchus was given to him by himself, but something he developed himself. Malchus is not something which is conferred upon you by society. Malchus, kingship, is something you develop within yourself. It's the ability to restrain yourself, to control yourself, to build yourself and to direct yourself, to be independent in your thinking, to be independent in your actions, to be independent and consistent in everything that one does and in one's opinions, independent both of society and of one's own ambitions and one's own desires, and to function only on the basis of what is needed, not on the basis of what is wanted, and to be prepared to suffer whatever unpopularity that brings within yourself and certainly among other people, to know that Al Pi Torah, that's the right thing, that's what has to be done. We had in the Vilna Gaon this afternoon that the symbol of kingship is the crown. That's a jewelry which is worn on the head, because the head is the symbol of kingship. Malchus is in the head. The ability to take one's emotions and direct them and channel them, the ability to take all one's different feelings and one's desires and one's drives, all one's limbs, the different parts of one's body, and use one's head to direct them, that's Malchus. That's why the symbol, the decoration of Malchus, is worn on the head particularly, not anywhere else. Soldiers go out to war, they come back with medals on their heart because it's courage. That's actions of the heart. If a soldier would stop and think before he jumps into the fire to save his friend, he wouldn't do it. The main thing is he was impulsive, that's why he did it. So he gets a medal on his heart. But a king wears a crown on his head, because that's what Malchus is. Not to be led by the heart. To use the heart, to consult the heart, to direct the heart, to function with the heart. But not to, that the heart should be the one that directs. Ultimately, it has to be the head that directs, and that turns the individual from Eved, from somebody who's continuously dependent on those around him, including himself, for his opinions, to Malchus, a person who, within the framework of his tradition, the framework of his training and his rabbein, is able to reach his own conclusions, which are his own personally and are original in his own sense, and to pursue them and live by them, come what may.